I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Welcome back, Sports to the Max, News Talk 830 WCCO. Timberwolves summer team's been playing pretty well, huh? Maybe they can get the, if they get the NBA season switch to the summer, maybe they have a pretty good chance. I don't know. Twins will engage tomorrow, 5:30 pregame, 6 o'clock first pitch, and finally they get play a game again, it seems like. You know, it's been so long. And this is going to be, it's not a showdown series for the Twins. It might be for Cleveland. But it's a lot of fun when you have series like this. And Terry Steinbach, I bring in, who was an all-star MVP, not just an all-star. And Terry, I was thinking about this when you see the Twins going up against Cleveland. It brought back some memories of between 87 and 92, the Twins and the A's were in the American League West, and of course the divisions weren't split up like they are now, and they were playing for it. And I've seen Tony La Russa comment about this, and he said it was akin to the Cubs in St. Louis when he was there. But that was one healthy rivalry for about 5 years, where every series you felt like might determine the winner, wasn't it?
You're absolutely right. It was just a fantastic rivalry, and very respectful, meaning that both teams play hard, both managers were intense. Doesn't mean that guys didn't get hit. Doesn't mean that, you know, people weren't trying to win. But the cool thing about it was how two small markets for 5-6 years kind of dominated the West and, you know, went to World Series and won World Series.
Yeah, and now they got the earthquakes out there in California, and that brought me back to you were there during the most famous earthquake of all, the odds of it being captured on a national television, but because you were playing the San Francisco Giants, and there's that very striking picture of you and your wife Mary at the time. It was just pre-cell phone. You know, a lot of people forget this stuff, and you have an earthquake, and your kids are on the other side of the Bay Bridge, which you can't access. That night, does that go down in your history books as you know, scary, certainly, but memorable for a lot of different reasons?
Absolutely. I mean, you covered all the topics of the, you know, the whole gamut. I mean, obviously we were 2-0, and, you know, we got beat by the Dodgers, you know, the year before. We think this is our time to win the World Series, so we're, you know, excited about going to Candlestick 2-0. Then you have the earthquake. We don't know what's going on, you know, and pre-cell phones and all that. We didn't know how bad it was until someone in the front row of Candlestick actually had a TV with a coat hanger stuck in it, you know, and that's when we're starting to get, you know, the feed that the Bay Bridge has fallen and the Marina District was on fire. And, you know, kind of at that point, you know, we knew we weren't going to play. And then you go to try to get home, you know, we couldn't find out how our daughter was. And it took 4 hours to get from Candlestick to Oakland because we had to go all the way down to San Jose and come back, you know, because the Bay Bridge is down. The San Mateo is a 13-mile bridge. That hadn't been inspected yet. They had no one driving on that. And, you know, and then you shift gears into the whole humanitarian aspect.
Yeah.
Lives were lost and millions of dollars, you know, of damage. And yet we got this, you know, I don't want to call it stupid little game, but, you know, we're thinking, you know, we're 2-0. I mean, we're away from being world champions. So it was very hard to, you know, differentiate between, you know, the humanitarian needs, the professional needs, you know, your personal needs about, man, you know, we're that close. And I think Giamatti hit the nail on the head, and he was the commissioner at that time, and said, hey, look, you know, we're going to play this game because this is a symbol not only to the U.S., but it's a symbol to the world that even after you have a major catastrophic event like the earthquake, we still rebound, we still get back, and we're going to finish this World Series.
Yep, and that was great. You delayed it, but you played it. And I mean, when it shook like that, I've never felt an earthquake. Did you go, oh my God, this is serious? Or what do you think?
Maxie, it was, I've been in a few little ones, you know, and you know, my wife, Mary, she hates them. She would put an upside down pop bottle on the table and if it tipped over, we knew we had an earthquake. And that's kind of the extent, you know, never really felt it. But if you can imagine the whole stadium, you know, your whole Candlestick being on a waterbed, And so when it first happens, like when someone sits on the old-fashioned water bed, you know, one's up, one's down. Well, we're sitting in the dugout, and I'm looking at my buddy Todd Burns, and all of a sudden he's up, I'm down, he's up. I mean, we weren't hitting the ceiling or anything, but imagine the whole stadium is doing that. So it did that like three rolls, you know, up, down, up, down, up, down. And then we had like four shakes, you know, just like where you grab a table and actually shake it. And he's a Southern California guy, and he immediately yelled out, earthquake, you know, we jumped out of the dugout. We had no idea, like, man,
Plus, you don't know if there's going to be another one, right?
Well, right. Well, then you have the old aftershock. Yeah. And I asked him how bad your thing was. That was like a four or five.
You know? Yeah, he knows exactly, right?
Yeah, and like I said, it wasn't until the TV, you know, the front row that we knew, you know, how bad it really was.
Yeah, that was a piece of history, and it brought back memories when we saw these earthquakes going on in Southern California, because that one, there was just too much that lined up for an earthquake that big to be during national TV. You kind of go, I don't know what you're trying to tell us up there, Lord, but that lined up just too, you know, I mean, to have it, the odds of that, having two teams from the Bay playing against each other when it happened, right. All those things. Importance, but certainly interesting, because they talk about that rivalry. The Twins and the Indians have a chance to have a healthy rivalry, at least for the here and now. Give me your take on the Indians, because we had kind of written them off, particularly without Carrasco and Kluber, and their starting rotation. We emphasize pitching so much. What is their secret sauce here?
Well, I think you got to give Frank Cohen some credit,
yep.
Number one. Number two, you know, anybody that has a history of knowing how to win, you know, Cleveland's been there. They know what it takes to win the division. They won the division. They have experience on that team. And I think the one thing you saw with them is that they didn't panic, you know, even when they were 12 or 13 games out. Now, the cool thing about it is Cleveland's probably played, let's assume, maybe as good as they could for a month and a half.
Yep.
And when it's all said and done, when you shake everything all up, they're still 5.5 games behind the Twins.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, history will tell you, can Cleveland keep up that pace? Man, I don't know. If they can, it's going to be one heck of a feat. And what the Twins have to do is just continue what they did that whole first half. You know, just play consistent baseball. I mean, team play, good pitching, good defense, good hitting. Are they going to lose a game or two? Absolutely they are, you know. But it's definitely no need to panic, and just have to continue riding it out and winning the games that they're supposed to win.
Do you think philosophically they're well built from the standpoint that they're going to swing from their heels a lot? You played on teams that were not exactly the same, but there were some similarities in terms of living with the long ball. Is that, if you have guys that can do it, is that a good formula? And particularly now where you just say, I don't care if it's strike two, go ahead and swing as hard as you can. Do you think that's a good, given their personnel, that's a winning formula?
I don't think it's a good formula, Max. We can talk to her blue in the face over many beers at many bars. I don't like that formula, but I have to say it's working. And I know Verlander's got a point to be made, and I just think, you know, there's something with the balls this year. Even Triple A, you know, they're saying the home runs are through the roof. And if I'm Rob Manfred, you know, the commissioner, and we want to spice up attendance and baseball and everything, I get it. You know what I mean? They need something to, you know, to get the fans out there. So with all that being said, and the Twins being built for that, or at least the first half, they showed that they can do that. You don't want to change now. You don't want to go to a Punch and Judy or a station-to-station team. I mean, you got to keep doing what you've done. So, yeah, I don't think that they'll change a bit. I think they keep swinging. I think the emphasis on averages these days in all of baseball is down. Adam Dunn, you know, in my era, was one of the first guys that really didn't care. He hit 200, struck out 200 times, and hit 20, 25 home runs, and that was a great year.
Yep, and he played the White Sox. You get frustrated watching him, because second and third, he didn't shorten up or anything. He was just goes, and he'd strike out, and you'd go, oh, if he just knew how to handle the bat a little bit better, right? He could at least knock the run in, you know, because they might be giving
Absolutely.
Him the run, you know.
Absolutely, and that's the part, Matthew, that, you know, I'm old school, man. I was taught the other way, get him over, get him in, put the ball in play, choke up and all that stuff, and that worked, you know, and I'm not saying that the philosophy that they're using now doesn't work. I mean, it's obviously working for them, and like I said, I hope that they can continue that this second half.
Who do you like in terms of a starting pitcher out there if the Twins were going to acquire one?
Well, if you can get Scherzer, I mean, why wouldn't you try to get? I mean, here's a guy. One, he's good. Two, he's experienced. Three, he's won. I think he'd be a great leader. He's an awesome competitor. I mean, to me, he almost seems like he could do to Minnesota what Verlander did to Houston.
That's what I keep thinking. The one missing piece, right?
You got to have that frontline guy. Not that the Twins don't. You know what I mean? Their starting pitching is doing fine, but when you can get that guy, I mean, you know, Jack Morris, you know what I mean? You can't pry the ball out of his hand. Verlander, he may stink. Actually, the year he traded to Houston, he wasn't having a good year.
Yep.
And all of a sudden, boom, you put him in a pennant race, and he smells the blood. He smells the championship. He smells that chance to win, and oh, my gosh, you know, the guy just took off. I think Scherzer could be that guy for Minnesota.
Yeah, and even if they want Royce Lewis, and I don't know exactly how he's tracking down there, and the organization has an opinion of all these minor leaguers, too. They see him every day. We don't exactly know how they see him, but if I could get Scherzer in control for two more years with this team, I'd be real tempted to give up high-end prospects as well.
You know, it's we don't sit in that front office. I think you kind of touched on that. But, yeah, I mean, us as fans, you know, you in the sports world, me as the next player, still watching the Twins, still on the win. Man, it's a tough call. And the one thing I will say, your window of winning is short.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you think you got all this young talent, you know, and you do. But the way this season's coming together, this might be their window. This might be their opportunity. You know, if you start banking on next year and the year after, all of a sudden – you know, Rosario doesn't have the year that he's having.
And, another guy gets injured, and here you sit, right?
Yeah, yep. And often the pitchers develop a weird thing, a blister that goes for a month and a half, or a sore shoulder. So, yeah, it's a tough call for the front office. I don't envy them one bit. I know they're probably up there every day grinding, trying to figure out what they can do, if anything, or what they want to, or what makes sense.
I don't even remember when Canseco got traded from the A's. I think he got traded. What had happened at that point in time in his career? Because he was a pretty productive player. Did he hit a point where he wasn't productive, or how did he leave Oakland?
Absolutely. He was, when he first came on the scene with Oakland, his first 3 to 4 years, Maxey, he was a bona fide Hall of Famer, no brainer, no nothing. I mean, he's got speed, he's got an arm, he played great defense in right field. He hit for power. I mean, he was a no-brainer Hall of Famer. And then what happened was there was 1 year, and it's kind of like Herbie touched on it the other day when he was on CCO. You know, you kind of get the all-star thing, and Herbie always got overlooked. Well, there was a gold glove opportunity in right field. And you know, sometimes it's not, you know, they're going with the veteran guy, and Canseco was kind of a new guy, and he honestly deserves a gold glove, but didn't get it. But mentally, that kind of affected him. His work ethic changed, his commitment to the game changed, you know, and next thing you know, that guy that's out there every day taking balls off all the right field walls and stuff and working on your throw to second, working on your throw to third, all of a sudden he quit doing on that. And here a guy who turned into a major untouchable asset for the Oakland A's was a major distraction. I mean, he was a distraction in the clubhouse. He was a distraction on the field, and it got to the point where, you know, Sandy Alderson, Tony La Russa, you know, our GM and manager at that time said, hey, we got to move this guy because he's not doing what he used to do, and let's move him while we can still get something for him.
And it's amazing because you would think he'd say, well, okay, not this year, but next year. You know, it's easy for me to say that, but it's just amazing how powerful human nature and the ego can be.
The funniest thing was, Maxie, about this whole deal is he kept telling Dave Henderson, they can't trade me. I'm the franchise. They can't trade me. And back then he had to be in the city by midnight. So the game started, I think, at 7 o'clock, or maybe it was a noon game, you know, in Oakland. And Canseco and Hindu were back-to-back in the lineup. And Canseco looked at Hindu. See, I told you they couldn't trade me. I'm the franchise. As he's in the on-deck circle, walking up, Sandy Alderson is on the thing. So, Jose, come here. They pulled him out of the game because he just got traded.
Is that right? That's how it ended, huh?
That was a true story.
And you're sitting in the dugout trying to figure out what just happened, huh?
Well, we knew what happened.
You knew what happened, huh? La Russa told you or something, huh?
Yeah, but it was a funny thing because Dave Hindu, you know, rest his soul, could tell that story great. You know,
I bet he loved it because he was good.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, like what the hell happened? Well, what happened is you just got your butt
trained. Did he just kind of walk out then, or did he say hi to everybody and say goodbye or what?
Oh, no, he had it. Literally, back then in those days, you had to be either on, if there was a rule, you had to either be on the plane
something,
or you had to be in the city by midnight of the trading date. So literally, I mean, he left the Coliseum straight to the airport, and we, our clubhouse guy FedExed all this stuff, like glove and spikes and bats and you know, whatever was all FedEx. But he had to be in Texas or wherever Texas was playing.
Yeah,
he had to be there, you know, by midnight that night.
Wow, that's a great story. I haven't heard that one from you, Stanley. One last question: the All-Star game came and went, and you're one of the rare ones that not just have played one, but you won the MVP when you played in it. Did you know that night when you hit the home run off of Gooden, when it got done? Did you know you had a pretty good chance to be the MVP?
I knew I had a chance to be MVP, Maxie, when I hit a leadoff home run, put us up 1-0. Then I hit a sac fly with bases loaded, put us up 2-0. Then I threw the ball into center field when Vince Coleman stole, and that let the National League score a run.
So you were in all the runs.
I was responsible for all three runs. Good and bad. I guess you're a hockey player, plus minus, I was plus one for the night.
but it wasn't the final score, 2-1?
2-1, yeah, and I was responsible for our run. Some too good and one bad.
Yeah, now the other night they gave it to a pitcher that had a shutdown, but offensively you're right there. What was that like when they come and give you that award?
It's a feeling, Maxie, that is so hard to describe. I mean,
you're with the best of the best in the world, you know, and they're handing you the trophy.
Well, just the whole thing about being in an All-Star game. I really wish that everybody would have the opportunity, because all the guys that you're trying to get out, you know, for me being a catcher, all these guys are coming up to hit. You know, I would acknowledge every one of them. Now they're my teammates. Pitchers that I'm trying to get hits off. Now I'm catching these guys, you know.
Yeah.
And that's just in the American League, because we didn't have interleague play back then. Now you're facing, you know, the Doc Goodens, the Daryl Strawbers, you know, the world, the best of the best in the National League. And then you go out and do what you do, and next thing you know, you're standing there with this trophy.
With the commissioner, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's the greatest feeling, and the saddest feeling is literally, I mean, that night we stayed up late. My teammates, we had five teammates there, and you know, we had a good time, and also the next day it's on the plane, and you're back to playing. And there we only had the 3 days. You know, you had Monday, Tuesday,
that's right,
Wednesday,
yep, and TK was your manager, yep. Right?
TK was the manager, yep. You're right. Absolutely right.
And Laudner backed you up, right?
Jimmy Laudner backed me up, yep.
Yeah. I mean, we had a lot of connections, yeah. Who was the starting pitcher for the American League? Was it Clemens or who?
Well, I want to say Frankie V, right?
With that. Oh, yeah, sense? Viola was a starting, yeah, and you were his catcher, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, and Viola was Cy Young Award winner, I think, that year, you know, because he was
I believe he
at
was.
That time.
Yeah.
Wow. Hey, Terry, great stuff as always. Appreciate it more than you know, and we'll check in again, but it looks like it's going to be a pretty fun second half, huh?
Anytime, Ashley. I enjoy it. Hey, what about that town ball thing that's going on out there?
Yeah,
I think a great job with that. That is really neat. I've been picking, you know, the episodes up as they kind of air. But again, that brings back.
Oh, you and I both got interviewed for it, and we played in the same league at different times.
Yeah.
Terry had a more memorable career than I did, but
hey, back then we were equal, Max.
Back then they don't have the internet; they can't look it up. But Johnson Park and Eric Gibson has done a wonderful job on that. And you know what strikes me, Terry, and I'm sure you, is, you know, we all think we went through a unique experience playing town ball, and you hear the interviews and you realize everybody had that exact same experience for the most part. I mean, you just feel so tied and connected, and guys that get married during the season, all those things that happen, it's so cool. But you realize how many guys had that same experience.
Absolutely. Whether you're in War Road or Schnurberg.
Yeah, exactly.
Schnurberg is, yeah. Either way, I mean, all the guys have that same feeling, the same memory. And you know, I know we're getting out of time, but to me, that what is kind of what we touched on about the intensity of baseball. Sometimes,
yep.
You know, you get caught up in the big leagues, and then you go back and see the sincerity of what town ball is. Here are these guys. It means just as much for them to play, to be a Schnurberg.
Yep.
As it did for me to be in the All-Star game and win MVP.
Oh, my God. When I was a kid, I thought town team was as high as you could go, you know? And I'm sure in New Ulm you had big Larry Jensen, that big right-hander that played professional somewhere. I'm sure he was there before you, and you watch guys like that, right?
Yep, absolutely. I can name guys. Bill Ryder and Steve Knisley, guys like that were guys when I was 4, 5, 6, 7 years old. I wanted to grow up and be just like them.
Yeah, well, that was that fun stuff. We'll do that another night. But Terry, thank you so much.
All right, Max, you take care.
You bet, Terry Steinbach. And I've told this story before. I played. Terry doesn't remember this as well as I do, but I played against him once. I played with him once too, over 35. But I played against him once in amateur baseball, and it was an unforgettable experience for not just because it was against Terry Steinbach, and I'll explain that next. So when I was done my senior year in high school at Gaylord, I got a chance to play on the town team, and I got a chance to start on the town team. And at that time, that was a big deal to me because I was just out of high school, and the town team is, generally speaking, guys that play in college and into their mid-20s and 30s. So I was just a young guy on that team, and I had a chance to play, was in the lineup. It was a big deal for me to be a part of that, and we had a good team at Gaylord, and we had to play New Ulm. And that's where Terry Steinbach played. Terry's a few years older than I. And the same week that we were going to play them was the baseball draft. And I'll be darned if they didn't draft four players. Think about this. Four players from New Ulm's town team got drafted that year. Terry Steinbach, Tom Steinbach, Doug Palmer, and Jeff Shugel. All great players. Terry and Tom went to the Gophers. I know Shugel went to Minnesota State Mankato. Then they already had Tim Steinbach, who was a great player, played for the Gophers on that team. And they had this Jensen that had pitched in the Cincinnati Reds, and Dave Reinhardt was a great pitcher from Mankato State. They had a loaded team. But we get the big break because these four guys have just been drafted into professional baseball. So we just dodged a bullet. We get to play them. Without their stars, right? Without the heart of their order. Four guys going to the pros, and we don't have to face any of them because they got drafted on, say, Tuesday, and now we're playing them on Thursday. So we get to the ballpark, we got a good chance to win this thing. You know, we just even the playing field. What we didn't know was that since they had not signed contracts yet, they were going to continue to play town team until they had signed the contract, and none of them had signed contracts yet. And so we looked down and go, isn't that Terry Steinbach? Isn't that? They were all there. And they were loaded for bear back then, man. That was one deep roster that they had. And Terry, and I remember playing the outfield, and I remember when Terry and Tom, I played against Tom for years. Terry never, you know, he signed and never saw him again because he sent it to the major leagues. But I remember the fly balls that they hit. This is the memory that I have. And I remember catching a couple of them in the outfield. And we had a real good pitcher, too, by the name of Dan Steer. And I can remember how high the ball went and thinking that's different. That's different. That's higher than most that I've ever seen in terms of trajectory. Now, this isn't exit velocity, but they must be doing something different to hit a ball that far, that high. That was good stuff. That's back in the day, and this town ball series has been a lot of fun to watch and to see stuff recreated like that. What do you do when your team's winning too much and you weren't ready for it? We'll ask the owner of the Minnesota United next. You heard the man. Twins tomorrow night, Minnesota United, they're presenting a problem for the people that work at Allianz Stadium because they keep bringing them back into work. They keep winning the U.S. Open Cup. Dr. Bill McGuire, owner of this team, joins us right now. And Bill, I was talking to you earlier this afternoon. You guys have had, in the last few weeks, I don't know, is this the pinnacle, the turnaround complete, the whatever, because all of a sudden it looks like everything's come together at once.
Well, I guess, you know, we hope so. certainly things have gone well the last several weeks. The team's played very, very well, consistently has looked good, you know, six wins in a row or so, maybe more than that, but across a lot of MLS teams and a couple others. So it's been good, and the fans have turned out. We've had, you know, great weather, great fan events, and great field play. So we're excited.
So I look at myself as kind of a shepherd trying to lead people through the understanding of soccer because I don't understand the MLS completely, and I get confused every day. Explain the Open Cup and how you become a participant in it.
Well, the Open Cup is really a national tournament almost where soccer teams from any level can participate. And it's built in a way that teams at lower levels, lower league levels start and then they compete and work their way up and progressively other teams come in the competition and you just go through a thing that ultimately involves, you know, hundreds of teams across the country and whittles down to the last one and you end up with a champion. Right now we're down to four teams. Minnesota United will play Portland. We just learned it'll be here. Another home game.
When will that be? Next Wednesday?
Oh, no, it's I think it's out in early August.
Actually. Okay, so there's a few weeks before you play again.
A little bit of time left. Then Atlanta will play Orlando in Orlando. And the winners of each of those two games will play each other.
So isn't that, I mean, I'm just on the outside looking in, but isn't that a great financial windfall when you end up playing a home game in front of a sellout crowd that you didn't know you'd get?
Well, it's more money than you thought you were going to get. I don't know if windfall is the right word. But,
okay.
You know,
but it's bonus. It's found money, so to speak, right?
It is. It is. You know, but the tournament's put on by someone else, and they get a piece of that too. But you know, the biggest thing for us, I think, is that we get to have more competition, and people get to see more teams and some great play.
Like New Mexico, how do they compare to other MLS teams? Team you beat last night?
Well, they're at the in the USL, the below MLS. They are a very good team. I think Coach Adrian, he's talked about that, and they've been playing at the top of that league. I think they're very near the top. They beat Dallas, who's at the top or near the top of MLS. They beat them to get to play up.
Yep.
So, you know, they've got a quality team. They're good. And, you know, like any sport, on any game day, you have a chance. So we're very happy to have played as well as we did and beat them. And they're a good team, and I think it was a good match for everybody.
What does a World Cup year, particularly the U.S. doing well, women's winning it, of course, what does that do for soccer interest? How do you feel the ripple effect of that?
I think it, you know, it's promoting the sport. It's making more and more people aware of the sport itself. Obviously, part of that is, you know, women playing versus the men's World Cup when the men are playing. But it is really exposure to soccer and what a great event it is and the energy and excitement that surrounds those games, those national games. And it was tremendous. Of course, it also exposes what great athletes the participants are. And we saw that with the U.S. women's team. You know, there's some great athletes out there, and they did an outstanding job under a lot of pressure. So it's good for everybody.
Has Allianz Field, to an extent, outperformed what you thought it would in terms of its meaning to this franchise?
I'd have to think about outperform. But it could be, you know, it's just been extraordinary. The stadium has been embraced by the fans. It's their stadium. It's their place. It's the home of their team. It has provided a great soccer experience. People that come here, the other teams are excited about it. You know, we saw the U.S. men's national team play here in the Gold Cup game, and the four teams, national teams that were here, all love the place. You know, we had Hertha Berlin, one of the Bundesliga's teams. They loved it. We got people from Aston Villa showing up today, actually, for that game next week. That's a Premier League team coming out of the United Kingdom. I think it's been great, and I don't think we could have asked for anything more. You know, we're still learning a little about how.
I was gonna say, yeah, like, has anything surprised you?
Well, I think the biggest surprise we've had lately is how many people have showed up for these non-MLS events.
Yep.
And, you know, a week or so ago we had 7,000-8,000, and boy, last night we had 12,000 people, and nobody really expected that for a middle-of-the-week U.S. Open Cup game. And that was just exceptional. It was exceptional. But, you know, it's also, you know, things we have to learn a little more about. Be able to anticipate.
Sure, and that's the fun part. It's fun to learn that way rather than the other way, right?
Yeah. No, that's right. This is a problem to have, and yeah. You know, but it's one we take seriously, and you know, it's important to us to keep this experience. And I, you know, anybody that's been to a game just comments about what an absolutely extraordinary experience. I think the San Jose game last week was just unbelievable.
Yeah.
The energy, the enthusiasm out there. How people responded, stayed around afterwards. You know, it was incredible.
Bill, appreciate it very much. We'll be in touch, but thanks for the update.
Yeah, well, thank you. We look forward to seeing you and everybody else at the next game.
You got it. Dr. Bill McGuire, nice enough to join us, primary owner of the Minnesota United. And you knew when it got nice that people were going to show up there in to a large extent. But when it's nice out and they're there and the team is winning, that's a pretty potent formula. That's, you know, when you get Target Field rocking like against Texas, they play two good games like that and they're sold out. Those are memories, man. You don't forget this. I was thinking of the little kid that goes to the game. You know, the kid that's 7 to 10 to 12 years old that has an interest in it. You might not remember who won the game, but you remember how you felt when you're at the stadium. You remember what the grass looked like and how green it was. You remember how involved the fans were. You remember seeing, if you're at Target Field, a home run. I've got lots of memories like that when I was a kid. Going out to Met Stadium, and it sticks with you, and it addicts you to the game because you want to play the game when you get home after that. You want to go out and play in your backyard because you sat there and you watched and you saw it at its highest level, and they had great big light standards, and they had vendors walking up and down selling malt cups and all these things. You don't forget that stuff. You know, you don't forget. I remember people say, "Oh, I saw it was the Polo Grounds and saw this and that." For me, it was Met Stadium. For others, it was the Metrodome. For some, it was, it's Target Field now because that's been in play for 10 years. But when you hit it right in the middle of the summer and you get one of those perfect, Allianz Field's doing the same thing for soccer fans, and you get it just right and things fall together, I don't know, man, but that gets inside you. That becomes a driving force. That becomes, one of the best things you've ever seen in your life at that point in time. When you have no perspective. And that's what Met Stadium used to be for some of us from our era. And the Metrodome, I remember the first time I walked to the Metrodome. And the guy's walking, bouncing the ball on the turf as he walks. I'm going, what is this? Pretty cool. And I remember playing in the Metrodome in college and thinking, whoa, man, this is like the greatest thing ever. You know, Bernanski was out here and all that stuff. You go back in the clubhouse and then Puckett hangs his hat here. You know, it's stuff like that. It was just really cool. Back in the day, and you see that that is being recreated this year, and we as adults need to pay attention to that because I think we forget sometimes how impressionistic our kids are, and that our kids are going to these games, and they're saying things, and there's something that's happening inside their bodies that is going to last a lifetime. They'll never forget how they felt the first time they walked into a stadium. They'll never forget what it felt like when they saw Nelson Cruz hit a home run and the crowd went crazy, and they watched the ball just almost effortlessly launched into left field that just almost floats when it gets into left field into a crowd that's going crazy in a frenzy and everybody's trying to catch the ball. That stuff is really cool. I remember watching the Twins and the Boston Red Sox came to town, and the Red Sox had Yastrzemski and Jim Rice and Fred Lynn and Dwight Evans and Carlton Fisk. I mean, they were loaded. And the Twins had a pitcher by the name of Jim Hughes. And Jim Hughes was you're not going to find his name in the record books, but he was off to a really good start. He had given us hope in the Midwest. He threw what they called a palm ball. And he was, I'm probably off on the 6-1, 7-1, 6-0, 7-0, something like that to start the season. And so this was hope because the Twins hadn't provided much hope in the pitching staff. They had Carew, they had Killebrew, you know, some of that stuff, but they didn't have a lot to go with it. And Hughes had given him this infusion. And so going to a game on a beautiful Saturday afternoon, one of my earliest memories. And they actually had brought the fence in a little bit because they weren't hitting enough home runs. And they had built a temporary fence in left field so that they could have more home runs. Well, it kind of backfired on them when you're playing against Dwight Evans and Carlton Fisk and Carl Yastrzemski. And I mean, we were sitting on left field and Hughes got lit up. I wish I had the box score. But they got on them early, and they were on it, man. They were hitting home runs into left field, and it was something. But why do I remember that 40 years later? I don't know why, but it was a beautiful day at Met Stadium, and it was beautiful green grass, and everything was big, and they were selling. You could buy helmets, any major league team you wanted, souvenir helmets. You don't forget that stuff. Now, on August 1st, they're going to go, hands-free. hands-free in the in your car in terms of the cell phone and your access to it and how you use it. I thought that this would be a pretty easy transition. Nothing's easy. I'll explain next. Welcome back, Sports to the Max. Russell Westbrook traded from Oklahoma to the Houston Rockets for Chris Paul and draft picks. So Westbrook and James Harden will team up and try to win an NBA championship, an NBA title. I don't know how that's going to work. They played together back in the day in Oklahoma City. Maybe they can get Durant to come over there and they'll have the big three back. Isn't that amazing? Oklahoma City at one time had Durant, Harden, and Westbrook. All three won MVPs. They had good scouts, I guess, there. But Westbrook is moving to Houston, and they get Chris Paul, who, you know, there were reports that he was not in harmony with Harden, et cetera, and they get to make another another run at this thing, I guess, in Houston and just do it a different way. I don't know how they're going to do that. He used to be just standing around and watch James Harden, and then whatever he did, you know, he reacted to it. Westbrook has to be involved in this, obviously, and they know each other well, so maybe that will make for good teammates. I don't know. But it'll be interesting to follow. And, again, the Timberwolves, it's been a swing and a miss this offseason. I don't know what their plan was, but whatever it was, I don't think it was this. You know, making an offer to D'Angelo Russell is not a plan. That's just a thought. Because you knew there was a better chance that he's going to sign with somebody else and sign a trade deal like that. You couldn't offer more money than they were offering. So I don't know. I don't know. I scratch my head sometimes. That's what I do. I scratch my head. So now we're going hands-free in August. So that when you get in your car, and this makes perfect sense to me. I subscribe to this. I don't want to see people texting. I don't want to see young people trying to text and drive and all those things. And so I had to come to terms with this and say, I need a head start on this because I'm not quite sure how you function on this, right? So I went to Best Buy, and I found out that the vehicle that I drive is too old to be, I don't know what they call it, Bluetooth ready or whatever. I drive older cars because I'm cheap. And so I needed to be set up with a phone. I need to figure out how to make this thing work, right? So they've got this deal, and it holds your phone. And you clamp it on, and you screw some things in, and it holds your phone in place so that you are hands-free, in compliance. And they're showing me this, and then another guy comes. There's always one guy on the floor, right? He really knows the game. He says, hey, come here. Let me show you what you really need. You know, don't worry about this BS up here in the front. You know, there's always a guy like that, you know? He goes, let me show you what you need. So he brings us back, and he shows me. He says, this is what you need. It's about the same price, about $30. So it's not expensive. And it's a magnet-driven. So you put a magnet on the back of your phone, and you can attach it. Then you've got this little something that you can, almost like a suction cup that you set, you attach to your car, wherever it's reachable and accessible for you from where you drive. And then you, through the power of this magnet, you literally, almost like Velcro, you put your phone on there, and then it sticks out, right? So now you've got the phone sticking out, and all you have to do is reach your finger down and touch it to access whatever it is you need to access. Well, that all sounds good in theory, doesn't it? It all sounds easy. But when you reach down and you realize that first you got to put in your password, and you're trying to do this while you drive, you're looking down to put your password in to get you to the phone app so then you can go voice activated and say, call, you know, Sid Hartman, whatever it is. Well, to do that, you've got to look down. You've got to enter your password. You've got to get into the phone compartment dingy-dingy and then be able to get to voice activation because you're trying to go hands-free and then be able to say it on the speakerphone, which you have to punch up, and then hope that it navigates and gets you there. And when you do this, when you your tendency when you punch on the phone is you knock it out of the magnet because it doesn't have enough leverage there. It's not stuck tight enough. So you touch it, and all of a sudden it flips out, and it goes down underneath you, and it's down by your feet by the gas pedal. I guess what I'm saying here, folks, is this is going to take some practice and some time and some patience. I thought this would be kind of a one-stop shop. It's easy. We must be set up for it. And they said you can get a headset so that you're not on a speakerphone. you can get a headset that you can attach to your phone and the dingy, and it will you'll be able to drive and maybe converse easier. At least the whole car won't be able to hear you if you got other people in the car. But I'm just telling you, as I thought this was going to be easy, but every time that I look down to enter my password or to punch in to get into the phone, it's not an app, but whatever you want to call it, you're looking down, much like you would be as if you were driving and you're reaching down to either text or to read a text or to even if you punch in the phone number. So I'm not sure how we get around that. I don't know. Maybe somebody can call us at 651-989-9226. Maybe there's an easier way, or maybe I don't know if you have Bluetooth. I don't know exactly what that means, but maybe if you have Bluetooth, everything's kind of hooked up, and you just and you can just go voice activated. I don't know, but I know that when you hook the phone with the magnet into this dingy thing that you put on there. And it seems like, I mean, it's sitting there and it looks good. It's firm, it's strong. You go, this should be easy. And then green, and whoop, the phone flips off. And you go, well, that's not what I wanted to do. And if somebody calls you and you reach too quick, you know, I don't know if you can't pull it off, because then you're not in compliance, right? You got to be hands-free. But you're allowed to touch it to activate it, but it takes more than one touch because you got to hit your password first. I don't know if I'm missing something here or not. You got to hit your password first just to get into the phone, the menu, before you can hit speaker and get them on the phone. So I don't know how this is going to all go down. I love the spirit of it. I love the fact that we're talking about trying to be safer, and we all have all seen people texting on the road and while you're driving, and it's really frustrating, especially when you see a young person that probably doesn't have that much experience behind the wheel, and they're texting while they drive. I get all that. I'm just not quite sure how we're going to navigate through this. And make it easy on all of us, particularly when we got a couple weeks to figure this out. So you can call us, 651-989-9226. Dick Jankowski, the comedian, in studio next. Get ready to laugh.
What up, y'all? It's your boy Danny Green, three-time NBA champ. You either rooted for me or rooted against me. Join myself and my co-host Harrison Sanford on the Inside the Green Room podcast.
It's a podcast that brings you never-before-told tales from the locker room, to candid interviews with basketball legends, to breakdowns of what's happening in the NBA right now. Whether you're a diehard fan or casual about your hoops, this podcast brings you the game like never before.
Follow Inside the Green Room on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.